Only in Africa do we find underhand dealings, politicians contesting for positions where they're not just idle threats, but there are also political murders. Also in Mexico, Philippines, in Turkey and Afghanistan. Come to think of it, the Russians have manipulated some elections outside of their own country. And the other individuals who want to rise to positions of prominence in the UK and in Spain and in Italy and the old Eastern Bloc. In fact, right throughout the world, there are politicians who don't deserve to be there, who are making life a misery for many other people. In fact, if you trace it back, you'll find it in 1 and 2 Kings. So if you've got your Bibles, please open to 1 Kings. We started our introduction last week, and we're into chapter 1. And this is a good story about political upheaval. Old kingdoms and governments make way for new kingdoms, and with new kingdoms you say, great, time for a fresh start. And everybody's gung-ho, everybody's excited. This new leader is going to give us everything that we've looked for. After all, we voted him into power. And it's just another failed government. You've got government ministers wanting to become prime ministers. You've got everybody wanting to take over because they can do things better. You've got civil servants who are neither civil nor servants. And it didn't start with the facade of democracy. It started way back in the Old Testament. In fact, I could take this lust for power right back to Genesis chapter 3 and chapter 4. Wanting to wrestle the power away from God and become like God in every way. And so there's nothing new under the sun. Everybody thinks, well, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to be different. This is going to be a different spell under a new CEO. And yet you look back, right back with Adam and Eve's sons, fighting over what they determined to be God's favor. Genesis chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face became downcast. Jealousy led to murder. That's no good, because it just carries on going from bad to worse. We've got the cycle of people seeking position, power grabbing. It's just a whole lot more subtle in developed countries. And so we see political battles beginning in Israel. And you'll see that there's not much difference in the world today. Let me just run through the main items that I'm going to be looking at. I'm going to be looking at the opportunity in 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 1 to 5. And then we're going to look at the opportunist, somebody who grabs that opportunity. And then we're going to look at the opposition to that opportunist. And then we're going to look briefly at some points of application before we go into the settlement, how everything pans out in the end. So if you've got your Bible to open, the first five verses, David is old and frail. I've got to mention it because it's there. He employs the services of a young hot water bottle. I don't know how else to put it. She's there to keep him warm, a young virgin. Now, if he needed another wife, he could have just said, I need another wife. If he needed a concubine, he could have said, I need another concubine. That wasn't totally unknown in the time. The old historian Josephus in his Antiquities felt it was probably appropriate to have a young person just keeping King David warm. So let's leave it at that for the moment. It does become quite interesting in chapter 2, verse 22. There are all sorts of other wranglings that happen there. And that's why she's mentioned, and that's why it's important just to put her in there. Back to the theme of the chapter. The king is on his deathbed. Everybody in the palace is discussing who the likely successor is going to be. In every other political context, the king would hand over the empire, the kingdom, to his firstborn son. If his firstborn son wasn't alive, then it would be the second son, and so it would go down. So there would be a likely successor. But if you remember Israel's history, it was slightly different because there wasn't a precedent that had been set yet. There had only been two kings. Saul was the people's choice, and David was God's choice. And they had no relation. They bore no relation to each other. In fact, David's best friend was the firstborn from Saul. His name was Jonathan. And Jonathan actually endorsed David becoming king, whereas in all the other nations around, Jonathan would have said, I'm next in line, I'm going to take that position of power. So no precedent had been set in Israel at that point. So there's an opportunity. And wherever there's an opportunity, there is an opportunist. And this comes in the form of Adonijah. So Adonijah sees the gap. You heard it read in verses 5 to 10. He says, okay, I'm going to grab power because if I can get there, I'm going to be rich, I'm going to be famous, I'm going to inherit the kingdom from my dad, everything's going to go well. I'm the next likely person to be able to run it just as my dad did. I don't think that it was his to take for a number of reasons. I'm just going to highlight a few of them. Firstly, we've got to give that right to the firstborn son of the king. And Adonijah is number 4 in line. Now, we've got to discount a couple of them. The first son raped a daughter of David. It was actually a stepsister to the first son. Amnon raped Tamar. So the third son in line decided, Tamar was his sister, decided to take it into his own hands, and he killed the firstborn son in rage. Okay, so that takes rid of the firstborn's gone. The secondborn to David would be Daniel. Not Daniel in the lion's den, it's a different Daniel. And we don't know very much about him. We don't know if he's alive or not. The third son is the son that killed the firstborn. His name was Absalom. You possibly know a little bit more about Absalom. Absalom's got this wonderfully beautiful hair. He makes a play for the throne. He wants to kill his father David in order to get the throne. Eventually he dies. His hair gets caught as his donkey's running under a tree. His hair gets caught. He's going to die, and Joab, one of the commanders of David's army, thrusts a spear through him. We'll get back to that in the sermon a couple of minutes from now. But just to note that this is now the third son, all of them quite scaly characters. And then the last one is Adonijah. Okay, so it could be that Daniel would still be there as a possible successor, but Adonijah seizes this opportunity. I don't think that he necessarily is the best person because he enlists the help of Joab. I've just mentioned Joab. Joab, a commander in David's army. And when Absalom was hanging there by his hair under the tree, it's Joab who thrusts a spear through him to kill him, bringing great distress to David. So Joab isn't David's favorite. But it's amazing how alliances work. You can get a nice political alliance with somebody that you disagree with completely just because you've got a common enemy. So, Joab is enlisted along with Abiathar, the priest, who's also not David's favorite. So the fact that he's drawing an alliance around himself of people who are disgruntled with David is quite interesting. The next thing that points out to me the fact that he's seizing power that doesn't belong to him is that there's no invitation to the royal celebration of the people who are close to David. David's wife Bathsheba, her son Solomon, next in line to the throne as far as God's concerned, they're not invited. So there's a very small company of people who are invited to the coronation of this new king. It does raise a couple of concerning points. And the last point that concerns me is that King David had been involved in God's succession plan. And God had told King David who would come next. It was obvious that God intended Solomon would take over from him, according to 1 Chronicles 22, verse 8 to 10. God says, "You have shed much blood," he said this to David. "You have fought many wars. You are not to build a house for my name because you have shed much blood on earth in my sight. But you will have a son who will be a man of peace and rest. I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side. His name will be Solomon. I will grant Israel peace and quiet during his reign. And he is the one who will build a house for my name. He will be my son. I will be his father. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever." So according to 1 Chronicles 22, God had already set that succession in place and said, Solomon's going to be the next king. Now we can choose to listen to God. We can choose to go our own way. Clearly, when somebody's going their own way, there's going to be opposition. And the opposition comes in the form of another unlikely alliance. It's Bathsheba and Nathan. Sorry, I'm giving you a whole lot of historical fact, just to help paint the picture. All these political connivings. Adonijah was opposed by Solomon's mother, one of David's wives, and Nathan the prophet. You remember Bathsheba was seen by David while she was bathing. He took her to his palace. He slept with her, had a child from that union, and killed Bathsheba's husband, then took Bathsheba as his wife. It was Nathan the prophet who went to David to say, "What have you done? I know that you've slept with Bathsheba." It's these two people who are keeping David honest and just reminding him what he should or shouldn't be doing. Something that's really important to us, if I make a point of application just prematurely, if we're not going to set the boundaries for our children, and if we're not going to draw those lines, somebody else is going to have to. Otherwise, they're going to end up in ruin. So far, David hadn't opposed Adonijah. It was almost too late. Look at verse 6 of 1 Kings. His father had never interfered with him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" He was also very handsome and was born next after Absalom. We need to surround ourselves with people who will call it as it is. Call out our sin. While I was thinking through it, I thought, would a spouse be a good person to call out our sin? And the answer is probably no. Firstly, they're not as objective as they possibly need to be. And secondly, we don't listen to our spouses. Well, that's a generalization. But we'll listen far more to somebody who's objective and outside rather than somebody who's close and feels emotionally connected to us. And David didn't only need a Bathsheba, he needed a Nathan as well. And with this duo, they come to rescue both David's family and his kingdom. It seems that with all David's power, with all his bravado, with all his strength against those who opposed God, he was a wimp at home. He wouldn't call out his son's faults, whereas he was prepared to go to battle against the Philistines. We need somebody like Nathan, somebody like Mordecai, to lead us spiritually, to give us direction, to be a sounding board. Nathan was the man who had the guts to confront David and say, "Your son needs to be brought into line." The plan was set up. Bathsheba would first go into the king. Nathan would then come in and back her up. A little aside again was to say that Bathsheba was not only worried about what would happen to the kingdom, she was also worried about what would happen to her. Because very often, as with other nations, in order to cement your power, you just take out all your enemies. And so her fear was there in verse 21. Verse 20 says, "My Lord the King, all the eyes of Israel are on you to learn from you who should sit on the throne of the Lord my King after him. Otherwise, as soon as my Lord the King is laid to rest with his fathers, I and my son Solomon will be treated as criminals." Well, it would be nice if Solomon was not like all the rest of the kings who put people to death. All right, let me just take you through a couple of points of application just to make this really practical in your own lives. Because at the moment you've had a whole bunch of history, you've had a little bit of theology thrown in. What does this mean to us? Let me pull out some points of application. Firstly, we note the danger of not opposing people who are unqualified or people who feel entitled to a position when they don't deserve it. Think very carefully about people who you appoint as next in line. If you're in business, your successor. If you're a one-man business, be careful of the employees that you have who might be longing to take your place. There are a lot of people out there who are never opposed. And as soon as they're opposed, they become really difficult to deal with. It might not only be disastrous for your company, it might be disastrous for your family if you don't oppose people. It might be a danger to your organization, possibly even to the country. Firstly, beware of the danger of no opposition. Secondly, keep praying for wise and godly counsel. We cannot emphasize the importance of wise and godly counsel enough. People who are objective enough to say, "I love you too much just to let you go. I love you too much just to allow you to carry on in the way that you're going." Pray for godly counsel in your business, in politics, in directors of the church and its leadership. Thirdly, the need for godly leadership in every home starts, need for godly leadership starts in every home. We need to be praying for people who are going to make wise and godly choices so that our children grow up with a sense of godliness rather than a sense of self-worth. Fourthly, if we continue to be swept up by the world, we mustn't expect that we're going to be blessed. The book that Steph held up earlier. We don't realize how much of an impact the world is making on our thoughts and our decisions. The algorithms that make you go back to websites that are specifically suited to you based on your history. You being fed things that you want to hear. That was the importance of having somebody like Nathan and Bathsheba speaking from outside of your perspective, saying, "Have you thought of it differently?" Pray that we would have the grace to be godly and sensitive in the way we present ourselves. The last one. Don't look to the world for political solutions. That sounds rather strange. Where else do we look? The answer to the world's problems and political problems are not in humans. I can't emphasize enough, every single human that you come across is going to let you down. Sorry to break it to you, if that's the only thing that you take away from my sermon, so be it. But you can't expect perfection from anybody who is imperfect. We're going to grow increasingly tired of seeing people who we thought would bring us out of the doldrums, just sinking us further into grief and sadness and distraction. Didn't we have wonderful thoughts of Dorota when he took over Eskom? And so you can replicate that in every space in your life. As we progress through this book, you'll see that high hopes were pinned on Solomon, and he let God down and he let his people down, as wise as he may have been. Let me go back very briefly to our outline, the settlement. And this is just a couple of minutes. David takes a stand. He does what he's supposed to do. He inaugurates Solomon. He strips the title, which was so deftly taken by his other son, Adonijah. And so we have the coronation of Solomon. You can read about it in chapter 1, verse 28 through to 40. And then Adonijah is finally put down in verse 41 to 53. I just want to close by saying there is somebody who's going to grab your heart. Not just in terms of love. Somebody who you owe your allegiance to. Everybody wants to be the captain of their own ship. We seize power from God. When things don't work out, we have a little bit of a hissy fit and we get all upset with everybody around us because we want to be the captain of our own lives. We've bought into the lie that we are the master of our own destiny, that we can influence, we can direct, we can control our own environment. We can make our lives what we want it to be. And as I said last time, instead of saying to God, "Thy will be done," you say, "My will be done." When you do that, you're saying, "I want to be king. I want to be king of my own enterprise. I want to be king of my own business. I want to be king of my own family. I want to be king of my own life." And it reminds me of Psalm 2. The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. "Let us break their chains," they say. "Let us throw off their fetters." The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them, and he rebukes them in his anger. And in his wrath, he says, "I have installed on Zion my holy hill, my king." Now, there was a great celebration. Solomon's come to power. The whole ground shook with the celebration. But one day, somebody greater than Solomon is going to be here. Somebody more important than Solomon. One day, every knee will bow to Jesus. Whether you want to or not. If it's not that submission that we make to him today and say, "You are my king," it will be the submission that the demons bow before God Almighty. The king's most unashamed rival will bow the knee to him. And no longer will it be bowing the knee to a humble, lowly king on the back of a donkey. It will be when the Son of Man appears in the sky. They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with great power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. It's not only in Africa that there's political power that's lusted after. It's within each of our own hearts. It's everybody saying, "I want a share of something that I can get." Legitimately or illegitimately. And one day we're going to have to relinquish that authority to the King of Kings. This book is not what happens in the corridors of power and the hallways of international finance houses. It's a story of the struggle that we have against God. And we're going to see how even the wisest king got it right and he got it wrong. But that's for next time.